The grade cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
Boys!
Get a few today, did you?
To be honest with you, I hate grade cricket.
I went into to play for a team called the name escaped me.
Obviously, showering's always a big issue. A big issue for young kids coming into a senior cricket team.
It was like a withered sleeve.
A bit of advice for the player. Yeah. Sort of one.
I refer to the great cricketer here, and I'll say this will do a little bit early.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer podcast. On today's show, we're talking how good is this guy Ashwin? How good is he? How bad is England? How bad is that pitch? That old conversation. Greg Blewett is on the show to tell us all things about Kirtley Ambrose, South Africa, circuiting before grade cricket matches. Hashtag RCDC. Also involves a phone sex call, humiliation, and cricket all meshed into one. Raheem Cornwell doing wonderful things. Australia and South Africa, that sort of follow-up gear. It's all happened on today's show. This episode is brought to you by Budgie Smuggler, as they all are. Use the code CHAMP for free shipping at checkout. Budgiesmuggler.com.au. My name is Ian Higgins. Sam Perry sits across from me and I from him. Welcome, Pez.
Hey, thanks for welcoming me. Can I just start by saying cricket can be good when Australia isn't playing.
Yeah.
That's the lesson from this week.
I've learned something this week, man.
I have.
Yeah.
You have, clearly too. That's why you said it.
Yeah.
That's why I communicated that.
You have a hive mind.
It's been really refreshing to cover India and England and then look at the other cricket going on.
Right.
Excuse me.
Jesus, Pez
is emotional.
Choking up. Fucking hell, man.
Out of our own arses.
They're just off spin. It's just Rakim off.
He's just on these
spin.
Ones.
Yeah, it's a doorknob.
Well, you're talking about Ashwin.
Oh, yeah, him as well.
Just like that.
A flick. Pez, I don't know if you caught this early in the week, but this week, ex-Inter Milan, Lazio, Juventus, and AC Milan striker Christian Vieri claimed that he would have been the best batsman in the world, comparing his style to Chris Gayle. Okay, mate. What do you want to do with that?
When I heard this quote, he goes, or read this quote.
Yeah. Remember where you were?
No, but...
Wasn't
like it 9/11. Reminded me of like the, I loved it. It reminded me of that phenomenon, that particularly Australian phenomenon of craving attention from America.
Yeah.
You know, when it's like, oh, Jordan Silks turned up on the highlights of ESPN for a catch or something. Like,
sure,
oh,
sure,
in the
sure.
American highlights.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, we love America. America's our dad.
Yeah.
We love that.
ESPN top 10 plays of the day.
But this is the gear that I want. Christian Vieri,
mm-hmm.
famous for being signed at Inter Milan, stepping up at the press conference,
good
saying
gear.
His sporting hero was Alan Border.
Yeah.
You know, that's the sort of gear I'm into. But in relation to this quote, he goes, like, you know, there's this genre of elite athletes from other sports thinking they could make it in cricket or in any other sports, and it does tend to grind the gears, and I'll speak on behalf of grade cricketers,
mm-hmm.
but of grade cricketers. You slave away for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And you got these coats in other sports going, yeah, I could have made it in cricket. It's like, you know, Nick Riewoldt. Lovely high arm action.
Yeah.
But can you do it on a flat surface for Dandenong twos?
Yeah.
You know, at 35 degrees. Now, right. The answer is probably yes, you can.
Yeah.
And you could have. Sporting success is just a genetic lottery.
It's just
got nothing to
lottery.
Do with skill or desire.
No. I worked hard, did you?
So when Christian Vieri, who was a striker for Inter Milan, Juventus, AC Milan, Lazio, Marconi earlier on, when he says he could have been the best batsman in the world... Well, he's probably right.
I know.
He's good because he's thick.
I have the same sort of dichotomy of thoughts in that, like, so he's got a quote here. It says, I'm on YouTube a lot watching cricket. My wife says, what are you watching? What is this? 3 hours a day watching games from 1984 and 1986. And she is going, what is wrong with you? Why aren't you normal? One of the great questions that we all face. Why aren't we normal? I love ex-players reminding themselves of their childhood and what could have been and that kind of gear. I mean, this is one of the all-time greats of the category of should I go around again.
Yeah.
Except Christian Vieri has no my cricket stats to go back on. He just used to watch the game a lot.
Well, we caught up with Ben Menenti, who would probably be the skipper of Italy.
Yeah, we'd be close.
You'd be close, you'd imagine.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they have been in touch, Ben Menenti and Christian Vieri. Might have to connect them.
You know how pro athletes are often good at multiple sports?
Yes, pairs? I do.
Even cricketers like Mark Waugh was good at 8 different, you know, things. Actually, Greg Blewett is on the show, wonderful golfer, played representative footy, good tennis player, reckons his mum played basketball for Australia.
That's what he reckons.
Yeah, that's what he said. I went to the tennis the other night, Pez, and I was watching Nadal. And I was just looking at him, and I'm actually watching the game, I was watching the dial for a bit.
Of course.
And there's nothing like obviously genetically gifted about him, but there's his body can just do things that others cannot. And it's just all part of that thing. So when Vieri says, I could have been the best batsman of Australia, I'm kind of inclined to go, yeah, you might have been. Even though there is no translation between curling one into top bin for Italy or Marconi and, you know, having a front foot press, getting on and off the front dog.
But you can see how he comes to that conclusion, because if he hits top bins for Lazio in the Champions League, he's like, well, I could face both of them.
I actually watched, there was highlights of both of them, like 130 something at the Gabba.
Good stick,
hair looking good, salad everywhere, fantastic, you know, no helmet, just doing wonderful things. Yeah. Bruce Reid's bowling 112 k's an hour. Let's just caveat every achievement that's ever happened being like not as good as what I could have been.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, good player. Now, Pez.
A little thought bubble.
Yeah. Sometimes I forget we're doing a show. Hey, Pez, on Patreon this week, hashtag AskTDC, Friday's episode 27. We get into some areas as we often like to do on that show.
Well, that's the idea. So what have we got? Bowlers are psychopaths. There was a story about a coat on a boat. That was in reference to Titanic.
Yeah, obviously.
Someone smashed a wind ball into their crusher's eye.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then, yeah, we've been sort of having this longer discussion about the sort of global alpha wars, historic alpha wars, and trying to work out who is the biggest alpha in cricket. Mm. As you'd imagine, that's a conversation that's going to take about 3 years to solve, like Carmen Sandiego.
We haven't got to Imran Khan yet.
Exactly. So. And that's why people should jump on and contribute to this. But we're now getting into the socio-sexual hierarchy about this. Finally. And people are starting to say, well, if you had a full team of alphas holding Bradman in his own way, spectrum way.
Mm-hmm. Wrestling.
Yeah, Benno, Chappell, etc. Imran Khan, if you will.
Yeah.
You might actually need a sigma male, not an alpha male, to alchemize them as a captain. And that's why people are saying perhaps Keith Miller would have been the captain of all. And that people are suggesting Keith Miller was a sigma male. I think he was an absolutely classic fucking alpha.
Yeah.
But they're the kinds of discussions we have. There's no wrong answers. Well, there are, but it's all in the name of entertainment and avoiding our lives.
Also this week, we had a few requests on Patreon for laying down the individual tracks of the bangers that often apply during this fair podcast here. We're talking Chop King Cologne. We're talking the Hogpile remix. We're talking Look Good, Play Good, Feel Good. They're all there. They're individual tracks. That's patreon.com/greatcricketer. Please do join us there for more of this kind of gear. Pez, India, England. Oh, baby. Rohit Sharma. Let's start with Rohit. He had 161. No, actually, before I say that, now, a lot of people who will be listening to this may not even be aware, but we're doing a daily series podcast on the India, England series. That's on YouTube specifically. It's just on YouTube that we're doing it there. You can go check it out. You can search The Great Cricketer on YouTube. You guys know how to find
15 minutes. Pretty sort of raucous, I'd say.
Just at the end of the day, space. So we're covering every single day as it happens at the end of each day. So, Pez, as we go to air, day four is about to start in about 3 or 4 hours' time. England are about to lose or mount one of the greatest comebacks anyone's ever seen since last month when India won at the Gabba, if you recall that.
Oh, if India managed to lose it from here, that's a war crime. I mean, that's beyond match fixing. They've won. I can just say it now, unless it rains. But that's how confident I am. It's a mark of respect that.
So if we haven't commented on Dan Lawrence's historic 315 to chase the game.
Yep.
Usurping Kyle Myers 200 and whatever last week. Anyway, Rohit Sharma hit 161. He hit 80 in the first session of that game and just completely won the game in the first session. Do you want to start with Rohit and then sort of get into like pitch areas and then Ashwin later on? We're going to Rohit first.
Rohit Sharma, big thick boy, big thick bat, knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
Caresses the ball with his railway sleeper.
Oh, yeah.
Took the game away. Classic aggressive opening bat hand.
Yeah.
No skittishness to it, just very skillful play from a side that knows how to win in home conditions, as we all have.
The guy averages 85 in India. I think will already go down in the category for greatest ever ODI player. He's got multiple double hundreds in ODI cricket. Mm. Wonderful player. But he's part of the psyche that we have in the West of, yeah, he does in India, a little bit like Ashwin was not that long ago, I feel
was,
like. You know, just like, no, they just do that there, so it doesn't count. Do you know what I mean?
Still happening now. Yeah. You can see the struggle of the Western psyche. So I know you're very in a very disciplined manner trying to stick on these players before I'm off the leash on that. But, yeah, unbelievable player, yeah. You know, and is very good in home conditions. That is also not a crime. It's the same as David Warner's like, yeah, but what about this weakness they have? It's like, until you're perfect everywhere, I'm not going to give you any credibility.
Yeah.
Which leaves about three players in the world who's worthy of universal respect.
Yeah. Yeah, of which I think two are probably in India. Mm. It's there's not many players in the world who open the batting in Test match cricket who can win a game in a session. Now, like in Test match cricket, you famously can lose a game in the first hour. You can't really win a game in the first hour. But Rohit Sharma in this game, now Ashwin scored 100 and he's probably going to take 10 for or 15 for in this game. He's going to win out of the match. But I think like the game is done by lunch on day one because Rohit Sharma's on 80 off 70-something balls. Everyone knows it's a fucking rager. And it's like, well, England don't have anyone in their arsenal who can do the same thing. And unless Joe Root scores another 120, they aren't going to even stay in the game. So like, so he's actually one of the only batsmen in the world, is my point I'm trying to make very poorly, that he can actually win the game in the first session on day one of a test match. Not many guys can do that.
We've been bringing a few football references into the grade cricketer. Mourinho often talks about killing the game. He killed it. Like, he killed the game by half time. Yeah. He killed it in the first 20 minutes. Like, watching cricket in India is a bit like that. Like, there's so much delirium in the crowd last night when England came out to bat, 46 guys under the lid. Like, when Sibley hit a single, it was like an away goal at Galatasaray. Like, silence the crowd. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. From the cacophony of noise. But, yeah, like, that's the mastery of the England side. Like, of the Indian side, particularly at home.
Yeah.
He didn't play that way just because he's a bit of a dasher. I feel like India, once they won the toss, they knew exactly what that game was and they knew how it would be won.
Mm.
So, and Sharma just went out and executed that because they have the players who are able to do that. And that's the scary thing about India is that we've always known that they're able to manage a game at home and know exactly what's going to happen. But it's the fact that they're able to do it away now as well, which frightens people.
That's exactly it.
We'll get onto that, yeah.
So let's go on to Ashwin now, man. Okay. I mean, what a fucking player this guy is. 5 test hundreds. Multiple 5-wicket hauls. Third time, what was the record he broke last night? He's now got three times in his career he's got a 5 for 100. That's more than Shakib Al Hassan,
Benno,
Jax Callis.
Yeah.
Who's the West Indian guy? Left armer.
Sobers,
thank you.
that guy. Gary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gary, nice Gary Sobers, they called him, for different reasons. You know, it's just records everywhere. It's unplayable. He's spitting cobras. He's batting 8 and he's scoring hundreds.
When it's an unfair pitch.
Yeah, when the conversation around the entire game is like, pitch is shit.
Yeah, number 8 comes out. That's a road. What they do to it?
What are you guys worried about? Yeah. He's slog sweeping balls out of the foot marks for 6.
Yeah.
I don't know the superlatives that we haven't already covered in this series online, but fuck me, man. Like,
big 4 months for him. Came to the Australia tour because everything's got to go through the prism of Australia. But... Mm-hmm. Wasn't saying place in jeopardy, but he only just regained his place.
Yeah.
He figured out a way,
yeah.
You know, which is what India has done away from home. He's figured out a way to succeed away from home, and now he's just come and he's just spitting cobras and realising the value of that investment.
I said this last night, but, like, has anyone had a better fucking 4 months than Ashwin? Like, just even his wife's getting involved online, just hammering Tim Payne, you know, that kind
of
gear.
It's a holistic approach because he's not only succeeding on the field as one of the best players on the planet, you have, like, in terms of the ability to impact games, any conditions, any opposition, he's now making social and economic impacts. I mean, socially speaking, his wife's come on and absolutely hammered Tim Payne and everybody else.
Mm.
Fantastic areas. Mm. He's also... you know, commencing the movement to legitimise the man cat or the run out.
Mm.
He's taken on Ricky Ponting there. We've said Asian Century before. It's becoming a cliche.
Yeah.
But Ashwin's leading it.
He's leading it.
And all that the Anglosphere has is Tim Payne questioning whether or not he's a dickhead. And I did note James Anderson sort of does something similarly on Tailenders podcasts, though in a lot more dignified manner. But essentially the message is the same. But, so you know, all we can say is, in response to Ashwin dominating with bat and ball, is like, yeah, but what's he like as a bloke?
Do his teammates like him? That's all we want to know. That's all we care about here.
Since when has that mattered? Look at fucking DJ Bradman.
Yeah. Yeah, not many people liked him famously. Hell of a stick, though. Hell of a stick. He's getting to the areas
really
now.
Good bat.
He's going to... he's going to go past 400 test wickets in this series. He only needs like 8 or 9 wickets. That's probably going to happen today. as we go to air. Go past, he's probably going to beat Nathan Lyon to 400 test wickets. I mean, it's just, it's fucking amazing. The trajectory of the bowling is like, that's, I think, I'm trying to figure out why it's so effective. Why is spin so effective? Why is their being Indian, spin so effective in India when you're like, now, we've said before, Jack Leach is a perfectly fine serviceable bowler. It's fine. But it's like, it's got the Anglo arc to it. It's like, he's spinning up to it. I'm looking at Akshar Patel, who's got the longest limbs I've ever seen. He's got a leg bowling.
Yeah.
Like he bowls with a leg on his shoulder.
Yeah. It's limbs. There is limbs for days everywhere. The trajectory is a washing machine of limbs.
It's literally bowls down into the wicket. And Ashwin is the same thing. Ashwin's a fucking unit. Fuck his shoulders.
Akshar Patel would bowl spin about as quick as you and I would steam in. I follow, man. Seriously. Yeah. Mate, this is the Western psyche stuff we're talking about. You're like, why does it work? Why does the angles work? It's the asymmetry of it. You know, muscular Christianity, notions of beauty are all about symmetry. Now it's all about everything being in sync.
Yeah.
Nathan Lyon is beautiful and symmetrical, but it means you can get a hold of the rhythm of it.
That's so funny you say that. Sorry to interject. I know you're on a wave.
You'll do it anyway.
But I'll do it anyway. Yeah. And I want to talk about something else. Now, yesterday, something happened to me. Get this right. No, I was watching that. The commentators were talking about, like, they're watching Leach in the warm-up before this game, and they were watching him work his back hip through at the same time as his shoulder. So, like, the rhythm of that was at the same time. It was all syncopation. It was all in sync. Not to be confused with the
in boy sync. Band. Yeah,
that's right.
Bye bye bye.
That's right. Mm. So to your point, exactly. Yeah, it's all fluid. It's all motion.
It's all sports science. It's all video. It's all, let's sit down, you know, at the SCG lecture theatre with some videos on. Mm. So
here's a pie chart.
That's right. And everything's in sync and biomechanically correct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, sort of, this is my read on what's happened with England-India this game, right?
Please.
India's gone down 1-0 in the series, just as they did in Australia, mm-hmm. in Adelaide. Mm-hmm. Chennai, they were on the beach, whatever, recovering from their historic win,
yep.
their century-defining win.
Yes.
Their century commitment, the start of the revolution.
That's right.
And so they're down 1-0. Mm. People are starting to talk a little bit. Well, hang on, is this real? And what do they do? They send in the Bunsens. Sharma got his thick runs with his thick bat.
Yeah.
Ashwin spat cobras.
Yeah.
Hyenas under the lid.
Yep.
Laughing. Delirium. Kohli, angry beard vectors.
Yep.
You're batting with guys under the lid until you die.
That's right.
It's a blueprint that served them well,
mm-hmm.
and will continue to serve them well for approximately a century. Mm. Now,
minimum.
All England could do with the Western psyche is laugh wryly at it.
Yeah.
Wry.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, when Dan Lawrence is out there in his first innings and a ball misbehaves off the wicket, and he just gives it the old side smirk laugh, you know, as in like, oh, that's, you know, this.
What am I supposed to do with this?
This isn't right. Yeah. And it's like, no, there is a way to play that. Mm. There is a way. We just don't acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening now, with great respect to Ben Folkes, is that England and Western psyche broadly are consoling themselves with the idea that he would have been the world's best wicketkeeper in 1997 because everything's neat and symmetrical. He's got symmetrical gloves, he's got neat hands and a wonderful face.
Yep.
And that's all well and good for the late 90s.
Yeah.
But wicketkeeping is the realm of Rishabh Pant now. Mm-hmm. Wicketkeeping is bombs. Yep. Wicketkeeping is taking hangers, being symbols a little bit because you're too destructive with the bat.
Mm.
There's a silent revolution going on.
Oh.
Ben Stokes can do nothing to India. Ben Stokes' chests and his pipes.
Yep.
His multiple chests.
His multiple chests, yes.
It can't save you in India. Only hands, wrists, and fingers mm-hmm. will do. Asymmetric movements is what wins. And we don't know what to do with our muscular Christian background.
There's no doubt about it that Ben Folkes, to me, and I've been saying this for a while, is basically a laser disc in 1997. You think this is going to be the thing that will take you forward. But meanwhile, India is the microchip that Bill Gates has put in people's brains.
Exactly. Ben Folkes is...
I've been saying this for ages.
Exactly. Ben Folkes is a calm, assured, sensible 42 not out that has no impact on the game. And we like it because it gives us some sort of sense of safety.
Yeah, that's
right. That's a very sensible innings. And this is really disrespectful. Ben Folkes has actually had a really good game.
Really good
by
game.
By the way,
averages 46 in Test cricket.
Really good game. Really clearly good game. One of the best keepers in the world, obviously. If not the best.
Yeah.
Symbols. But
yeah. That's not my
wrong
problem.
Wrong century, brother. You know? Time to move on. Time for Philippi. You know, the question is, how do you beat India now? What do you do? You've got to get asymmetric. You've got to start doing wrist exercises, finger stuff.
I wonder if England are having this.
Fucking hell. 20 years too late, folks. Good player.
I wonder if England are having the same existential crisis that we are having on the back of what happened here in Australia, where I wonder if like the rest of the world's looking at being like, oh, what a great result for India. No. That's the tsunami warning that a wave is coming. This is fucking game over.
It's China tariffs on wine.
This is Stalingrad.
Well, hang on. We're a piece of gum on the boot.
Yes.
Of India.
That's right.
And the way Australia is actually currently conducting itself as a global cricket citizen would reflect that at the moment. Whatever you want, Dada. Anything you want, Dada. Anything at all.
I look at what's really interesting about watching like other teams play is you really do get a sense of like why other teams hate Australia so much. Because this is the way they go about it.
Love it.
The way they go. Now, I'm looking at because
the first time you'll have watched a lot of
it is
teams play that aren't Australian.
Even as I was living in the UK, I watched like the home summer and stuff, and it's all in the background still of like, oh no, Australia, because Australia weren't the best team in the world. They lost the Ashes when I was there, but
no, they weren't for about 10 years. We still just thought in our heads.
I still have my Steve Waugh poster in my bedroom as a 24-year-old. But it's really interesting, and it goes both ways because Ben Stokes is doing handstands, right? And they come up for tea. That's just, I'm waving the white flag.
Yeah.
We're marching towards our death here.
We're caught in the rip.
Now, if Steve Smith is doing handstands, which I reckon he's not that far away from doing, to be fair, when he's batting, when he leaves the white side off stump.
Yeah.
If that happened, there'd be riots in the street on George Street outside. There'd be, don't worry about anti-masks, there'd be the anti-Smith riots in the streets about there's a cunt doing fucking handstands first slip walking onto the field. Don't get me wrong. Good laugh. Now, that's not reflective necessarily. I'm putting that Australian lens onto what that reflects onto the field. But at the same time, the umpiring in this test match has obviously not been up to stand. They've made a huge, like really glaring fundamental errors of process. Like for instance, there was Rahane in the first innings. Jack Leach had him caught off the pad. If you haven't seen it, basically it was one of those ones where it's a bat pad situation, misses, but there's a ball balloons up, it kisses the glove. Now it gets reviewed and the umpire basically doesn't review it all the way, doesn't watch all the footage. And England's out there being like, what the fuck is this? Another one, Rohit Sharma, late on day two, leaves the ball, clearly doesn't play a shot. LBW would have been out, but said he played a shot. Anyway, the umpiring is like obviously not being up to a test match standard in this game. But the reaction of like the English and team was very dignified.
Yes.
Especially Joe, very dignified, obviously dismayed, but in no way was there carry on. There was no carry on.
There've been about five or six incidents in the match where you wonder, were it Australia experiencing it?
Yeah.
You know, that we could be at the point where there is diplomatic tension between both nations.
Yeah.
But there just seems to be fewer social flashpoints.
There's no social flashpoints.
They just play.
Mm.
They just laugh a bit more.
Yeah.
They just accept when things don't go well. And that's why they've lost.
That's why they're fucking weak.
Exactly.
And they'll never win.
There's
shit.
There's the head growing out of my shoulder.
Michael
again.
Clark's
like,
right.
Shit. What happened?
As I'm describing about like, you know, just the sort of the, not even genteel, just the polite nature of the way to go about things and to accept things, whatever. I've just got every fucking fourth grade captain in my head.
Exactly.
These guys are fucking shit.
Exactly. Doing your fucking handstand. Walking in Australia.
Playing fucking tiddlywinks.
Well, there goes the YouTube CPM. Well, the other thing you can do when India's destroying you on their own home patch.
What's that, mate?
Rather than maybe assess how you might be able to become better at playing spin bowling or work out some of the nuances of the way the ball hits the wicket, sliding across the top, or you can actually just dog whistle pitch unfairness or umpire bias.
Of course, yeah.
You can do that as well. That's absolutely a disgrace.
Yeah.
That's an absolute disgrace the ball behaves like that. I mean, India's able to play it somehow. But, you know, as Jonathan Liu put it, you know, the question is it morally acceptable for an Indian venue and an Indian ground staff to produce an Indian-style pitch for an India home game?
Mm. Well, that makes actually a good point when you think about it.
When you think about it, is that acceptable?
You're saying India a lot there.
Mm.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
Makes you think. Makes you think.
Do you think, Pez, because I'm not really that fascinated in going into like the Twitter realms of like having a massive argument about the pitch and the Twitter battle between Vaughan and War and Warne and whatever. But I wonder if like both things can be true in this instance that like, okay, I thought when I was watching day one and day two of this test match in Chennai that the pitch was shit. And I think that can also be true at the same time as like, it's not unfair. I think that the notion that a pitch can be unfair is just ridiculous, like, because literally both teams have to play in it. So there's that. But I think at the same, like, when I was watching this, I thought this pitch was going to be so much worse, because, like, day one, it was like going through the top. It wasn't ragging from foot marks. It was going through the top of the surface. And so, like, and I thought it was just going to deteriorate into fast, basically. And it hasn't. It hasn't done that. But can both things be true? That, like, the pitch was a little bit, it was spinning too much, but now you're getting into maybe
I don't think anyone's saying semantics. It's a world-class pitch.
Right.
I think it's just when the conversation just starts to tip over into the notion that it's shit because it's not what we're used to.
Yeah, like, that's ridiculous. And I think you can, like, ridiculous,
understand a pitch zoomed out in the global context. So I think pitches like that have a place in the context of all pitches all over the world. Yeah. I think an Indian Ragga is part of the world of pitches that exist.
Yeah.
If every pitch was like that in cricket, the sport would be worse for it.
Yeah.
But it's the pace of the declaration of unfairness and the fact that many people aren't willing to examine that perhaps it feels shit because we haven't oriented our skills to work on that pitch, you know, and I take your point. Like, I don't think anyone's saying it's a 10 out of 10 pitch or a 5 out of 5 pitch. It's just when it just tips over into, like, it's just shit because it's not what I'm used to.
Yeah. Do you want to – should we just quickly preview the third test, which just starts next Wednesday?
Right.
Next Wednesday week. I'm excited for this one, man, because it's in Ahmedabad. They haven't played there in 6 years. It's
new stadium, isn't it?
The match is at the Motera Stadium, world's largest cricket stadium, 110,000 people
just
capacity.
Just getting better.
110,000 capacity. So it's overtaken the MCG now for the largest cricket stadium in the world.
Another symbol.
And they're only selling 50% capacity of tickets because of COVID. So there's only going to be 55,000 people there.
Fucking hell.
Which is more than any other ground in the UK, definitely. And most football grounds, I'm sure. It's a day-night test.
Oh, my God.
But it is a day-night test. Now,
be a lot going on.
Oh, mate, there's fucking... I was thinking before, we're watching the end of the day's play last night when England had to go in for the last, like, 40 minutes or an hour or whatever it was, and it's like, that is the most fun you can have in cricket, where your role in the day is done. You don't play any more roles in the game. The pitch is ragging. There's men around the bat. There's LBWs. The batsmen don't know which way it's spinning. I mean, I've never played in front of a crowd, but there's a crowd going on. Rishabh Pant's laughing and appealing at the same time. That's so much fun. And that's going to be happening for the next 5 days of this test match.
But now it's like pink ball, Broad, Anderson, so, maybe. Yeah. I mean, they only usually play one of them now. But, you know, that should even it up for England a little bit. Yeah, what's India going to produce? Is it going to be another Bunsen? That'd be funny.
Do you have any sort of inkling here? So Australia can still make the World Test Championship final if this series finishes 2-2. There's a day and night test. You would have to say that going into the series, England would have been like, this is our best chance to win a game. They obviously played fantastically well in the first test in Chennai.
They did.
Can they make it 2-1? And then, I mean, I've kind of got a bit of...
100% hoping Australia somehow. I mean, I cannot countenance an idea where England would perform in a manner that would benefit Australia. Yeah. We've talked about this before. It's not in the particularly English psyche to do that. They'd sooner lose than benefit Australia. But, yeah, I mean, I just pink ball, brought Anderson. Okay, that's a thing. Mm. Maybe something can happen there.
Archer will come back.
Yeah.
You do this all the time. You go through India's opposition. You're like, okay, that looks pretty good. I'm looking at England's batting by sheer numbers. It just looks really short. Only Root and Stokes, who averages 37, average more than 35 in tests. Folks averages 46, but he obviously has played limited games so far. And so looks a bit short there. And then I look at, like, who's going to play for India. So Bumrah was rested for this test. He would probably come back for the pink ball test. And then, like, I'm looking at, like, the lower order for India. Washington Sundar hasn't played this game. Will he play in this pink test? And they'll play maybe Sundar at 7, Ashwin at 8, Akshar Patel 9, Bumrah and Ishant 10, 11. I mean, it's fucking batting for days and good bowling attack.
Yeah. When's Jadeja back? Is he out of the series?
He's out for the series,
He's a good player.
Yeah. He's the best all-rounder.
Yeah.
So they're good.
Yeah. India, the BCCI will have to invite England back into the series with a good pitch.
They will have to,
By good, I mean... Western good.
It's actually going to be a drop-in from the nursery ground at Lord's.
Yeah, that's right.
It's actually mostly synthetic pitch.
The Indian series bingo hasn't been completed until Kohli hits a monster double tongue with his angry beard vectors.
Kohli just hasn't, like, won them a game in so long that it's going to happen 8 times in a row.
Oh, my God.
Now.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing sets it up really beautifully for the return series in England as well.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
can India go and do them over there?
When England will be
really on our knees.
England will be preparing spinning tracks.
Just to make it fair
for their visitors. Hey Pez, West Indies Bangladesh, mate. This has been a great series, just two test series, and it's a great shame that we don't see other teams. We don't see other countries because we don't
other teams play.
Other teams play.
Did you know that?
And so to catch people up, obviously Kyle Myers and the West Indies chased 395 in the first test. Last week.
Fifth highest in test history.
Amazing result. Now, in this second test, the West Indies win this by 17 runs. Obviously, the West Indies are decimated because most of their players are playing in this Dubai T10 league where blokes are bowling with backwards caps and there's some other fancy shit going on. Some carnival cricket happening around the world that most of those players are playing at. Jason Holder's injured, so the captain of the West Indies and friend of the show, of course.
Oh, of course, yeah.
He's not playing either. So
COVID concerns as well, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All makes sense, but mate,
it's their third grade side.
I was watching this. I was watching this, and I was like, "This is real test cricket." You know, yeah. you know when you go to like a you go traveling, or you used to anyway,
yeah.
and you go to like somewhere slightly off the beaten track. You know, this is real Barcelona or wherever you've been. You know, it's not the
and invariably it isn't because you're there.
Because you're actually in Tasmania. Yeah. This isn't Barcelona.
You know, like if I'm here, this is not the real place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Mate, there's just really good players playing for the Test country, and it's just a shame that we don't see more of this. West Indies in this game had a really good lead. Then they got rolled for 117 in the third innings. Then they bowled Bangladesh out for 213. The West Indies win the series 2-0. First overseas series win since 2017. First in Asia since 2012. Blah, blah, blah. Rakim Cornwell, though, Pez.
Yeah.
Player of the match. He took the new ball in each innings, 5 from the first innings, 4 from the second, takes the winning catch, and he's massive. He's a big boy.
Pretty comprehensive summary, mate, to be honest. And that, I guess that famous image now of about 13 blokes hanging off him as well after he's won the game.
How good that circuit.
And he made that novelty check that he got look really tiny. That check's actually 2 meters big. 2 meters big. I'm in words.
He got paid $1,500 for performing that well in a game.
Yeah, it's really good. And, you know, the West Indies, like, we're going to talk about Australia and South Africa in a second, but there's a global cricketing citizen. I'm just looking this up, and I noticed Gideon talking about this on his podcast with Pete Lawler as well. But during COVID, West Indies have gone to England, New Zealand and Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
The year before that, they went to India to play Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
They played India over there the year before that. The year before that, they went to Sri Lanka and Zimbabwe. So England aside, Australia have been to none of those places for test cricket during that period. West Indies have been everywhere, you know, and you know that it's a function of where they sit in the hierarchy because there must be hierarchies.
Mm-hmm.
But, the role they're performing in international cricket is, well, it's, you know, we're really lucky to have them, and it would be great if other countries were like that too.
I'm right in remembering, aren't I, that they took a 50% pay cut to go to England.
You are.
And
so Godspeed West Indies cricket.
Fuck yeah. And also when we spoke to Jason Holder, we're talking about the place of cricket in the West Indies, and they're talking about how, like, a huge reason why they are playing their third grade team is because financially their board is just cooked. Like, there's just not the money that there should be available, despite the efforts that these guys are making to go around and play cricket all the world. And it's good cricket as well. It's amazing cricket that more people should see and more people should know these players as well. Now, it's funny when Australia, as an Australian watching cricket, as a broad fan, right, you won't know anything about Craig Brathwaite, who's just captain this game, or Joshua De Silva, Portuguese guy who's wicket-keeping for the West Indies. You won't know anything about them because unless they play in your country for like one or two tests, you know nothing about them. And it's a real shame that they barely come here, what, every like 5 years. We never go there. So you're not learning anything about any other cricket. Now,
we haven't been there since 2015.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I mean, do you want to, should we follow up then about, you know, South Africa and Cricket Australia relations.
So we picked this up, we talked about this for the last couple of weeks in a very light sense. I mean, last week I said, if took medical advice that it's not right to go to South Africa, then you probably have to take that on face value. And since then there's been, I think just after we published, there was a huge article coming out from Neil Manthorpe, who'd been briefed by South African Cricket Administration around, you know, how upset they were about the way relations had proceeded when it came to Australia going over to South Africa. The insinuation was that Australia set, an infinite number of hoops that were almost designed not to be able to be jumped through.
Mm. And when they were like, oh, here's another one.
Yeah. You know, there's that quote around, if you want somebody to fail, just continually set them tests that are impossible, you know. Mm. That's exactly how the quote goes.
That was Newton, I think.
You know, look, who knows? I think a lot of good judges are essentially accepting Australia at face value when it comes to South Africa. But Gideon Hague, again, you know, master, wrote a great piece in The Australian a few days ago that zoomed out from it and put it in context, the main point being that Australia's standing as a global cricketing citizen is greatly diminished by not doing things like this. Jonathan Liu said that it almost feels like Australia will just play whomever they want, whenever they want. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be as strong an obligation to helping out other nations. Mm. And when there's so much great cricket going on at the moment, not grade cricket, although there is a lot of that too, that's on TV now. It stands out that Australia is not playing. I know it's for specific circumstances at the moment, but there is a broader pattern of Australia only playing whoever they want.
I think that's right, mate. It's and when you look at how much cricket is being played, and you said this last week, the back catalogue of like tests that need to be caught up, and Australia have now finished their test calendar until the Ashes. What the fuck is that? Yeah.
And when they go
how
to
is
India
that possible?
In 2022, they won't have played an away series for 3 years or something like that. Again, extenuating circumstances, but it adds up a little bit when you start to look at countries that haven't played, people we haven't seen for a long time, and those that we do play and how often we play them. You know, does it say something about our attitudes as a country or our cricket administration's attitudes around, you know, what the priorities are? It's just a question, and I think it's a fair question.
I agree. And I wonder if this is actually saying something about where this is all going. Where, I don't want to get into a big conversation about, like, will Test cricket be played in 5 years' time? Mm. But these questions will be answered in the broader context of time when it goes on. It's like, well, they stopped actually playing Test cricket because there was just no money in it, or whatever the reasons are. But it seems explicitly that, like, unless there's good money in it for us, we ain't going. Mm. Like, there's nothing in this for us. Like, just playing a bit of money so you guys get your broadcast. Like, that's what it feels like, right? Mm.
Yeah, I guess so. That's what it has a. It definitely has a bad optic to it.
It's a bad optic.
It's a bad optic.
Hey, Pez, speaking of optics, just a really quick one before we go to speak to Greg Blewett.
Now that's a good optic.
Pat Cummins was announced as the New South Wales captain in a team that Steve Smith is playing and available to be captain. Mm. Steve Smith in the game against Victoria. It was a one-day game. Pat Cummins captain for the first time. Steve Smith scored 127. Of course, he didn't got man of the match. Don't know if you saw the quote after the game. He said, upon reflecting upon Cummins' performance as captain, he said, pretty easy day.
Yeah. Love it. Love that. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
It's an endorsement, though.
I'm not sure people really picked that up. Well, I was going to say, I love this idea that states are making endorsements for Test captain. And New South Wales, which is the heartbeat of Australian cricket, and when New South Wales cricket is in Australia,
that's right. That's right.
New South Wales have opted for Cummins over Smith.
Mm-hmm.
So they're firm, you know, and we did have friend of the show Ed Cowan on say that he believes, and he's on board, Cricket New South Wales, saying he thinks Cummins should be the next Test captain.
Yeah.
Cummins made 49, took 3 for 30 odd, run out, looked good.
Of course he did.
You know, that was fine.
Yeah.
I suppose it was interesting. Ollie Davies debuted as well, hit 50 off 3 balls.
Yeah. I think it's all pointing towards Cummins being next captain.
It seems like that's the move, that's the movement, but there's always. There are always figures in Australian cricket who are, you know, may have different views, but they don't express it publicly. So
yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Hey, Pez, we spoke to Greg Blewett, and of course,
and who do we do it for?
Well, Pez, we do it for the fans, but mainly we do it for Ponting Wines and Ricky Ponting himself,
who may or may not be aware that we are doing
it. All of our guests this summer are brought to you by Ponting Wines. Use the code GETAFEW for 10% off the price of a case. It's pontingwines.com.au. You know the deal. Delicious drop. Pontingwines.com.au. 10% off the price if you use the code GETAFEW. Different way of saying the same thing over and over again. Here he is. Here's the great man, Greg Blewett.
It's Queensgrove Sports' massive birthday sale. All brands reduced to clear. Kookaburra, Grey Nichols, New Balance, GM and more. Everything's priced to make you think it's actually worth it. Need a new stick to kid yourself that you'll actually average above 11 this season? Don't waste your money on actual therapy. Try retail therapy instead. We've got last year's stock with this year's stickers and double the price. We've got the brands of yesteryear too. Remember MRF? Brian Lara used one, so that must mean you're good enough to use it too. Flintoff and KP used a woodworm. I'm pretty sure they went into receivership, so we're basically giving them away. Remember when Albion sponsored Chris Martin, the worst batsman of all time? I have no idea how these bizarre alien pads didn't sell out. We've got them! What about those weird Indian brands that look like railway sleepers, weigh the same, and have absolutely no middle? We've got you covered. We even sell bats with no stickers on them, so it looks like you're trying to get sponsored, even though you're in fifth grade. So rush into Queensgrove Sports today and make this season your last.
Okay, here goes. I think we were talking about this bloke off air and how he kind of came through as a prodigy when we were kids.
Oh, yeah.
We looked up to him for a lot of reasons. Yeah. And let me say some of the numbers.
Please.
Let me regale you with some numbers here.
Thank you.
46 tests, 2,500 runs there, high score of 214, 4 tons, 15 50s, 14 wickets, a ton in each of his first two tests, 232 first-class matches, 17,352 runs, an average of 44.49, so that's 50. high score of 268, 43 tons, 63 50s, 140 wickets, and a best of 5 for 39. Just some words here. Stylish would be my word, top order bat.
Yeah.
With a proclivity for the pull shot, very alpha for the 90s. Sexy little bowler. at the faster end of medium pace.
Yeah.
And that's at a time when it was very in vogue.
Sure.
Brilliant fieldsman and pretty good looking rooster.
Oh, yeah.
If he doesn't mind me objectifying him like that. And so I'm, of course, talking about Greg Blewett. Bluey, welcome to the Grade Cricketer.
G'day, boys. Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm a bit nervous, to be honest. I've spoken to a few of your guests that you've had on over the years, and the grilling that they've got is that's still scarred. So I'd love you to go easy on me, but great intro. Thanks, boys.
Well, you know, we may as well start that grilling now. Can you name names? Who?
Kirtley?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Brad Hodge.
Yeah, Kirtley. Ian Chappell was still talking about how they used to use the spa and what happened in the spa. Still can't believe you eat that out of him. Brad Hodge, he's a regular, isn't he?
Yeah.
Hodgey?
Oh, he was. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he asked us to stop texting him. I think the last text was, "I'm just not interested." And if you do know Shane Watson, let him know he's welcome on the show. All right, well, Bluey, let's start from the beginning. You know, you played grade cricket when grade cricket was grade cricket.
Yeah.
Okay, so the last few interviews we've done with people, we've kind of skipped it a little bit because a lot of the guys coming through today, they skip grade cricket. It's a bit of a faux pas to play it.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get into the systems and blah, 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 get to the top, not really go through that, you know, correct masculine, I guess, introduction, conditioning process. But you played at the right time. So tell us about your relationship to grade cricket.
Yeah, well, firstly, my old man played a bit of cricket as well. So he played, about 20 Shield games. He was around that Ian Chappell era. So he was a battler. Dad was a battler. He thought he was Ian Chappell. He was a poor man's Ian Chappell, put it that way. He loved to sledge, but he was pretty shit. He was a left arm ortho who batted a bit, but he was a bit of a grade legend. So he played for, I think, about three or four grade clubs here in Adelaide, and then he got into coaching. So I basically followed the old man around because we grew up in the Barossa Valley, or I grew up in the Barossa Valley, I should say, and then we moved back down to town when I sort of started high school. And then Dad continued on his coaching, and we first started at East Torrens District Cricket Club, where he was the coach, and then I went to Prospect because he flicked over from East Torrens to Prospect. And then I ended up at Kensington District Cricket Club. So that was my own choice. But I went from, East Torrens to Prospect because I basically needed a way to get home from school. So Dad had take me home. But I've copped a bit of flack, actually, you know, because I'm involved with the Redbacks and all the guys have looked me up and said, I noticed you played for three district cricket clubs. And I was like, you know, weren't very loyal, but I was just trying to get home from school, basically. So that was the reason why I swapped clubs a couple of times. And but great memories. I remember at Kensington District Cricket Club, we had one of the War boys, Dean War, coached the Kensington District Cricket Club, and he was captain as well. and it used to piss me off. Every warm-up was exactly the same. And we used to do the triangle as a bit of a fielding warm-up, your underarm one to the stump, and then you pick it up, and then an overarm to another stump, and then back to the keeper.
The T-drill.
But he refused to get stumps, and he used to put his batting gloves down instead of stumps. Oh. And I'm like, Dino, please, mate, like, can I bring the stumps? And he's like, no, it's working. It's working. So that is one of my memories. But, great cricket was there was a great era when I grew up. Around the scenes in Adelaide, firstly, following the old man around, and then, playing was great.
I like it how you described your dad, Louis, as a bit of a battler. Pretty sure he captained South Australia at some point. He's pretty shit, but I've done orthos, whatever. I want to hit some notes here about how much of a worldie you were growing up. I read that you went to Prince Alfred College in Adelaide in your later years of high school, and you scored school hundreds in years 10, 11, and 12, the only person to ever do that, which is a fair achievement given there's a few decent cricketers that play for that school, including all the Chappell brothers. So at what point did you know you're going to play for Australia? Year 10?
I was going to say year 7 when I got to I was dominating up there. I actually played, I was in the Barossa, and we were in the Sapsars, and I was actually in the team with Darren Lehman, so that's how far we went back. But I'll tell you what, you never really think you're going to play for Australia. I went through the system, actually, through the SACA, under 15s, under 17s, under 19s. And then actually when I got picked for Australia, I still didn't think I was going to play. So it all happened pretty quickly.
Like what does a junior team look like with Greg Blewett and Darren Lehman in the lineup? I mean, did anyone else get a go?
Darren Lehman he was named Boof back then because his head was huge. Like we were 12 or 13 and his head was massive. So that's how we got the name Boof, because he had a Boof head.
12-year-olds calling him Boof.
Yeah. Good. I can see that.
And we were called the Barossa and Light. So, Buford coming. It was the same as when we played cricket for South Australia. I'd sort of go in there and do the hard work, take the shine off the ball, and then get out for 30. And then Buford just come. He just cash in, ruin it for everyone else, really. It was the same thing, all the way through.
Mm. I mean, I've read many times, I heard the anecdotes as well, you're an amazing golfer as well, but I didn't realise you played rep footy as well in South Australia growing up as a kid. And any other sports you're amazing at?
I actually was all right at athletics as well. I won, so I did little athletics, and at the end of that there was an Australian championship, and somehow I won the gold medal for triple jump. Can you believe?
That was my guess.
Yeah, triple jump. I was going to say,
triple jump. And that was the last time I ever did athletics because they made us train about five nights a week leading up to the championships, and I missed a bit of cricket, missed a bit of footy, so that was it. But I was like everyone else. I reckon I played a bit of basketball, played tennis. My mum played basketball for Australia, can you believe, as well. So
here we go.
A bit of a, the genetics are quite good.
Yeah, it's in the bloodline.
The genetics are quite good.
Yeah, it's like the wars.
Bluey, forgive me for sort of calling this out, but you mentioned Ian Chappell earlier, and when we talked to him about his experience playing grade cricket and then even test cricket, he was talking about secretly taking photos of guys in the sheds. And you have just talked about underarming a ball at a gloves. So, like, did things clean up in South Australian grade cricket or, could it get a little bit like the Chappell era in the sheds as well?
I heard about the way to get rid of the tinea. That tradition kept going, I can guarantee you that. Our big thing for our club was if you were late for a game, that was an automatic carton. So I've got a bit of a story there. I don't know whether you guys know. Not one of my proudest moments, but I was
going to ask you about it.
Well,
you've actually said a few things already that have caused off a question. I was going to frame it in kind of like sympathetic terms. You've had a moment like you said that's probably not very proud, where you've clearly had a bit of a circuit the night before, and. Thankfully for the public, it's been spotted by officers, put it that way, and you've had to make your own way to the ground. Turns out you're still a pretty good stick when
you hit him?
When you're twice the limit.
Well, that's the thing. So I'm going to do a bit of name dropping here. I was actually out with Dennis Lilly and Jeff Thompson.
Okay, well, yeah.
Worth it.
So they got hold of me, that's about all I can remember.
They got hold of you with them.
But anyway, yeah. So long story short, I was running late the next morning, and got pulled over by a police officer, and things didn't go very well. But I ended up getting to the ground. I was about 2 hours late, so I had the bat a little bit lower, and I had to buy a carton on the way because I was late. So I had to do that. But it was a Saturday-Sunday game. So I ended up making about 70, and I reckon I got four for the next day. But at the end of the season, what we call our Bradman medal, which is our grade trophy. So that was the biggest, apparently, I wasn't at the night, but apparently it was the biggest roar for the night, was when Kensington versus West Torrens, round 15, such and such one vote, such and such two votes, and everyone was waiting, and it was, gee, blew it, three votes, and they all, I got a standing ovation. So, not one of my prouder moments, but I've got the boys over the line. That wasn't all bad.
Well, you did, or Dean Wall was captaining. There's still a piece on this hungover from the, is that an apt word for it, from the BBC in 2002, and Dean Wall batted with you. You sort of got the team over the line, and he said, although he was twice the limit, I've seen him bat worse. Some people just play better. With the lack of inhibitions.
You know what? I don't think I ever batted better hungover, but I reckon I always bowled better hungover. I just felt a little bit looser, a little bit less. I was a bit more carefree. The rhythm was better in the run-up. I honestly say that I reckon I bowled better when I was hungover. What about you, boys?
It's all about the same. I think I had some theories that, like, if I just have a couple of drinks on Friday. But Friday night was the best night of the week to go out. So that was sort of my excuse. And it made no difference, really. It was all the same. I still got my front pad blown off.
Friday night was always the best night because you knew that you weren't really meant to be out. That's what always, they're the more dangerous nights, aren't they? When you're not, you should be home. You've got cricket the next day. Mm-hmm. I'll have one more. Things snowball from there.
Yeah, it gets away from you. Maybe this is a good time to segue, because there's a great story in your debut test match for Australia. You scored the 100, obviously, but overnight you're 91 not out, and you're debuting with your good friend Peter McIntyre, the great leg spinner, of course, from South Australia as well. And it transpires there that you're 91 not out, first test match. What should we do? Couple of beers.
91 overnight.
91 not out, not overnight. A couple of beers that night, and all of a sudden, the next morning, Craig McDermott's in the hospital.
I was a bit of a thing for routine. So the night before, I went out for a couple of beers, and I was home early. But that sort of era, I felt like, a lot of our guys in that era felt like, staying in your hotel room, thinking about the next day wasn't necessarily the best way to go about it. You're better off sort of going out, having a couple of drinks, socialising, not thinking about the game too much, and then just, worry about it when you wake up the next morning. Mm. So the night before I was 91 not out, I remember having a couple of beers out the back of the members, actually.
Great spot.
Great spot. Oh, so good. It actually pissed me off some years that I was playing test cricket. I was rather be out the back with my mates. They look like they're having such a good time.
But anyway, really good time.
So I just thought, 91 not out, what am I going to do? Well, it's obviously worked the night before that I went out and had a couple of beers. Yeah. So I thought I'd do exactly the same. And that's what happened. I reckon I had Damien Fleming hanging off me like a bad smell. That's what happened. But the next morning, there was a bit of commotion the next morning. But anyway, we got there in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't long after that, Bluey, that you went on the 95 tour of the West Indies, at the time was the sort of unofficial World Test Championship at the time. Yeah. And I guess my question about that, you probably think I'm going to ask you about Steve Waugh. I'm not. A few years ago, we spoke to Brendan Julian about this tour. He was on that. Mm. And he refused to comment about his performance on the circuit. And I just want to know why. Is it because he was so prolific no one's allowed to talk about it? Mm. Are you able to shed any light on what Brendan Julian's bringing to a Caribbean circuit?
Yeah.
And while you're at it yourself?
Nah, I was rubbish. But BJ was, I'll tell you what he was. He's only just starting to loosen up now and tell us a little bit about what went on behind the doors. Because he was a bit unlike Warnie. Like, Warnie would get to the ground and sort of, you know, the first thing he'd want to talk about was the night before, you know, and what he got up to. Whereas BJ was, you know, if someone had spotted BJ out and if he was, you know, how would you say it, leaving the premises with someone else or, you know, you'd sort of go, mate, how'd you go last night? Oh, no, straight home. Early night. But it's only just starting to sort of come out now that BJ was, he was going for it.
Yeah.
He was, but he would never tell you at the time, which I quite like. He was shy. He was too cool. He was too cool to really sort of let on what he'd been up to. But no, he was good. Very good.
Yeah. I suppose while we're in the vicinity, Bluey, you know, it'd be remiss not to ask about that famous spell of Curtly Ambrose to Steve Waugh in Trinidad, third test, 1995. It's David Byrne at non-strikers end, but you're next in. And Steve Waugh is, you know, just giving verbals to Curtly. Are you just in the sheds there just like, mate, can you shut the fuck up? Because I'm going to come in next. Like, can you stop angering Curtly Ambrose, please?
No, it's exactly what you're saying. I'm going, what the fuck? What are you doing, mate? What? Firstly, what's this going to achieve? Like, you're only going to egg him on and make him angry. And, and even more worse is that I'm in next.
Yeah.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. Like, what are you doing? So, I don't think I got many either when he came in because he was still angry. But, don't know what he was doing.
Mm. Mm. Well, speaking of Curtly, we just saw the anniversary of that wonderful delivery he bowled you in Perth, where it grubbed along the ground. And I think Bill Laurie said terrible pitch, etc. Everybody likes watching it because it's insane. do you ever just reflect on that delivery and just think, I could have dealt with that differently, actually?
I often get reminded of it. This is going back now probably about half a dozen years, and I was commentating at the MCG, and I had a toilet break, and I went to the toilet, and there was a bloke next to me, and he pulled his phone out, and he goes, "Bluey, remember this?" And he had it up on his phone, and it was the delivery that Curtly bowling to me at the Wacker. Do I remember it? Yeah, I do, mate. While I was trying to zip up, but I had the great pleasure of playing against Curtly in England, and because he never ever spoke to any of us throughout his career, he just sort of, you know, give you a bit of a stare, but he'd never open his mouth. And I was playing for this team called Lashings in the UK, which often had, you know, a sprinkling of West Indians through it. And Curtly was playing this day, and I was like, I was still scared of him, but he came straight up to me, goes, blew him up. Hey, you remember that delivery at the Wacker? Straight, mate. I'm like, Curtly, I do remember it. But I also remember that was the second innings, and the first innings, I reckon I made about 14 or 17 or something like that off about 60 deliveries. And after that, I sort of came off, took my pads off, and I had a good hard look in the mirror, and I was just going, mate, what are you doing? So I decided in the next innings that I was just going to take it to them. I was going to, you know, try and go to run a ball and, you know, because getting 14 off 50 balls was getting us nowhere. And then I copped that first ball. And then I remember listening to Ian Chappell on the replay saying I should have got forward to it. So I still don't reckon I could get forward to it now.
I mean, you famously had a bit of a torrid time in the 90s, not just in Test glory, but in first-class cricket too. But, I mean, maybe you weren't always to blame. There's a great Robe Linda 2 clip. I mean, they're all great. But this one's titled Worst LBW Decision Ever, Greg Blewett Facing Mushtaq Ahmed in 1999. Mm. You're on 89 and you leave a ball, a leg spinner that hits you outside off stump and is given out. Yep. I mean, there's always talk now about umpires and standards, especially this year with the Big Bash and all that kind of gear. I mean, how much better is the umpiring now, though, than back then, do you reckon?
Oh, it's definitely better. Yeah, definitely better. I remember that decision so vividly. I'm not one of these guys that reflects on my career too much. But I made a couple of 99s, but also, yeah, remember that 89 that I made up the Gabba because I reckon Michael Slater made a big score, 150 or 170 or something like that. But I felt like I had it under control. Yeah, just shouldered arms to one that was almost off the pitch. It really was. But I was given out. But, yeah, we could have done with a few referrals back in our time, yeah. No doubt about it. But I suppose that's the biggest difference, isn't it, the referrals that the players have got. Mm. And we probably wouldn't have got away with some of the decisions that, you know, that we got favourably as well. So different eras for sure.
Mm. I noticed that when you were giving out the baggy green back in those days, there was no sort of presentation ceremony for giving out baggy greens. You just sort of flung some kit, you know, your jumpers.
In a box.
That's right. Mm. And you were given two baggy greens, I believe, on your test debut. So which one of those is the one that you wear around the house and to the shops and stuff?
Mm. well, often I just wear... the one that I've never used before, or I never played in, I often just walk around the house, and that's the only thing I've got on. And the boys, I've got two boys, 4 and 6, and they sort of often look at me going, "What is that on your hat?
What's that on your head?"
I should say. But that's great research. That is great research. So yeah, I think it was a mistake because Peter McIntyre, who you said debuted with me. Mm. He only got one baggy green, but I got two. So the second one, which I didn't ever wear, that's hopefully going to get my sons through private school when they get older. Because I never wore it. But no, I've got them both tucked away, and now that I've had the two boys, they'll probably get passed down to them. I don't know who's going to get the one that I did actually wear, the one for my 46 test matches, but we'll work that out as we go.
Let them compete for it.
Yeah. I've heard some other guys in the past auctioning off their bag greens under the guise it's their only one. Everyone's actually got 4 or 5 of them in the closet. Yeah. Everyone does things differently. But I want to ask you about the great, no doubt the highlight of your career, Bluey, Australia A versus Australia, playing for Australia A. Some of the great memories when Australia is just dominating. When we were basically India, what India are now with an amazing team and depth. But like batting against like Warner, McGrath and that ODI series, you know, Healy up to the stumps. I mean, is there like a severe intensity to that rivalry? Because I was a kid, but I remember it being like, no, everyone's going for Australia A here.
Oh, hell
and,
yeah.
And was that sort of like, was that sort of in the air a bit as well? I remember there's a great confrontation of McGrath pushing Hayden. Do you remember that? The SCG, I think it was. So was it?
It was a weird push. It wasn't a very coordinated.
It was a bit weird. It was a bit weird. But like, you know, was there like this sort of intensity in those matches?
Yeah, huge intensity. I mean, it was great for us. Like it was a free hit really for us because, you know, we were, you know, the young guns, I suppose, coming through and playing in front of, you know, capacity crowds. But, yeah, I remember the Australian team, they were really pissed off because, you know, they obviously travel overseas and go to places, you know, like Pakistan where they'd get pelted by batteries and stuff like that. Mm. And then they'd want to come home and, you know, play in front of a crowd that went for them. But everyone was going for us. Mm. So, no, they were great times. It really was. I did feel for those guys a little bit for about 10 seconds. And then I thought about how good a time we were having. But and then the final series was great as well. Like we probably should have won at least one of those games. But you know, to play Damien Martin was the captain of Australia A, and yeah, they were great times. They really were. Even Merv Hughes played for Australia A, can you believe? So you know, I did feel for the guys in the Australian team a little bit, and there was. I don't think there was any angst towards us. They were just, you know, they were just pissed off that everyone was going for us.
Speaking of, you know, players, I suppose, that fly under the radar a little bit, I've always been curious watching the commentary. Obviously, James Brayshaw is a great mate of yours, fellow Sacker, et cetera, and he's known around cricket, I suppose, especially with younger people, as a commentator and presenter. And he's very articulate with his ball-by-ball stuff. Very few people know that the bloke averaged 40.
He was a fucking gun.
And he was a gun bat. Well, why doesn't James Brayshaw talk about his cricket more? And if he can't, will you?
No, he was a good cricketer. You're right. And he gave the game away quite early. I reckon he might have been just before his 30th birthday. So, yeah, I think he was pretty clear on where he wanted to go with his career. He was petrified, there's no doubt about it. He didn't like the short pitch bowling. He didn't like the guys that got it above 130K. He had a bloody good career. Merv Hughes used to absolutely give it to him. But his record against Victoria was unbelievable. And I reckon, you know, his average was, well into the 40s. And I remember him telling me that he reckons that I haven't looked this up, but he reckons his average for South Australia was better than my average for South Australia. So I just give it to him. I said, mate, if you want it, you have it. So I haven't looked into it. But no, he's a bloody good cricketer. You're right. But he's very humble as well. Like he's happy not to talk about it, and he's made a bloody good career for himself, hasn't he? So he's had to move to Melbourne. He's very well entrenched in the media there. He does great work for Triple M and Channel 7, and no, he's done bloody well. I'm proud of him.
I was like, well, we're obviously all Channel 7 colleagues. You would have known we were Channel 7 as well. And on that note, Bluey, thanks so much for joining us on the cast finally. Sorry it took so long. And obviously you've done way more research than anybody else. So really appreciate your stories, and no doubt we'll catch up with you soon.
Good on you, boys. Thanks very much for having me. Loved it.
In fact, there weren't many players before the war who liked Bradman.
That's life.
Just fucking back properly.
That's what all the people say.
You have to give me the hog pile.
You're riding high in April, shot down in May.
Funny a banter.
But I know I'm gonna change that tune.
The little bastard didn't even put 50 quid on the bar and say, boys, have a beer.
Funny a banter.
I said that's life.
Hog pile.
That's life.
And as funny as it may seem, some people get their kicks.
Funny banter.
Stomping on a dream.
At least my teammates like me, dickhead.
But I don't let it get me down.
The little bastard.
Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around.
Boys, have a beer.
I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet.
If we didn't want him to come and have a drink with us.
He goes, you can just feel the little chill of winter around the Australian quarters. Only in Melbourne, really. Probably not in any other state. But that means that footy season is upon us. And our great friends at Budgie Smuggler have a great range of footy-themed Budgie Smugglers. Now, that may not mean too much to our English or Indian brethren or all the other countries that play cricket that we sometimes observe and may listen to this show. But Budgie Smuggler has an amazing rugby league range, NRL range. In particular, they've just released North Sydney Bears Smugglers. Now, that's a very niche reference for this cricket podcast, but I don't care. They've got North Sydney Bears Smugglers, but any other rugby league team that you go for that you may support, you may think players are hot. I know a certain radio station just did a list of the 100 hottest rugby league players.
Really?
Yeah.
In history?
All done by blokes, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Is that in history?
No, they're just current players. So current players rated zero, like from 100 to number one. It was a countdown.
Yep.
Rated, and the term was hotness.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that's a broad
you
term.
You don't reckon players would have been looking at that. They would have certainly set the cat amongst the pigeons, whatever that fucking means. What? The players are a cat? What's a pigeon there?
Who's the pigeon there?
Yeah, and what are they attacking and eating? Yeah, that doesn't work.
How old were you when Andrew Ettinghausen did his was it a photo shoot he did for like play
boy?
Yeah, is there a play girl?
Cricket?
Yeah, inside. How old was Andrew? How old were you when Andrew Ettinghausen posed nude for inside cricket
for play cricket when he went over to England
for inside that season?
Well, it would have been 1990 or something, 91, five or six years old. What an attractive player he was.
Mm-hmm.
Would have looked fantastic. I'm sure he does look fantastic in budgie smugglers. But if you do get around the footy kind of gear, I'm sure there's a lot of Aussie Rules listeners. There'll be plenty of that. You know, you guys have anything you want, really.
Yeah. And whenever you want.
Again, if footy is your gear, if you want to design some Premier League stuff and maybe avoid the wrath of the Premier League brand and stuff and make sure you get that kind of approval.
Sure,
we can design some budgie smugglers around that
theme
as well. But I just wanted to talk up the NRL range of budgie smugglers. And just broadly, again, you can get any accessories or anything, design your own. You know the drill from this Australian-owned, Australian-made small business who has essentially kept the grey cricketer humming along off the back of their business intelligence, but also wonderful people.
Yes. We
support them, please.
Everyone knows that they've been huge supporters of us, and we ask that you support them.
Mm.
Where can we do that, Pez?
At budgiesmuggler.com.au. Use the code CHAMP for free shipping.
Hashtag RCDC.
Oh, this is good. Don't normally say it.
Oh, there's a couple of belters coming up here, Pez. And thank you to everyone who has written in over the past little while. If you like more of this kind of gear, patreon.com/grovecricketer. We do this every single Friday for hashtag RCDC Fridays.
Buckle up for these.
Pez, this one comes in from Anon.
Mm-hmm.
Comrades, anonymity required. Some years ago, I worked on a phone sex chat line. The job was advertised as a one-to-one chat for lonely people, but the call centre was in the basement of a kebab shop in Finsbury Park, so perhaps I should have known better. Finsbury Park, Pez, that's, I want to say, North London?
It is, just next to Highbury. I used to live
near
just
you.
Next to it, yep.
Back in the day.
Yep.
On day one, the very first thing I heard on answering the phone was a northern man saying, "Hello, can I wank while we're talking?"
And then wank while we're talking? I suppose it leads, is it? Let us know. No doubt it's wrong. Hello. Can I wank while we're talking? Is that? I'm trying to think of how would Brezhnev say that?
I call it the Joel Wilson situation.
I call it the Joel Wilson. Hello. Can I wank while we're talking?
And then the penny dropped. So not the job I thought I'd sign up for, but it was cash in hand and my coworker had already made me tea, so I thought I might as well stay. Okay, I said to the caller, fire away. He started chatting a lot of very generic filth and I quickly realized that I should be saying encouraging things and making appropriate noises. So I did, and matters reached their inevitable conclusion within a few minutes. I worked the evening shift and shared a desk with a woman of about 70, with almost no hair and maybe four teeth. I offer this solely as a description, not a judgment. She went by the unlikely name of Bambi.
Sounds like a little bit of judgment.
And would drink four super strength lagers and smoke two joints throughout each shift, but she had a breathy Marilyn Monroe type voice and was therefore very popular with the punters. She taught me nine card brag, which we played during calls. The calls were all variations on the same theme, so it was easy to multitask while talking customers through their repetitive fantasies. Bambi had a regular client who would stay on the phone for ages. We got extra money for keeping callers on the line for a long time, so we all envied her this bloke. One evening, Bambi was off, so I fielded her regular phone call. The caller was exceptionally well-spoken and very polite. When I explained that Bambi wasn't there, he asked if I'd mind stepping in because his wife was at her Italian conversation class and this was his only chance to call. I agreed and immediately he began a 10-minute monologue of the most richly detailed and inventive account of his humiliation at the hands of his cricket team. It involved him playing a game where everything was going wrong. He dropped catches and ran teammates out or failed to save a boundary. And after each mistake, he would be shouted at while having some kind of cricket accoutrement shoved up his bum by the umpire. Sometimes quite forcefully and several times over. The whole scenario climaxed literally in him being spanked by his captain with a cricket bat while both teams looked on. What was unusual about this wasn't the bum stuff, which is obviously very popular, or even the being humiliated. It was a detail and the poetic way he recounted it that was impressive. He described bat strokes and balls bowled and the troubling state of the wicket with great elegance, and also the precise way stump and bail and box were used to shame him. It certainly confirmed to me the idea that cricket might be the sport with the best riders attached to it. Later, I asked Bambi about it, and she said he wasn't the only one into this kind of cricket-related stuff. And for one punter, she even gained a rudimentary understanding of LBW in order to add some authenticity to her chat.
What does that sound like?
Yeah, but did it hit him outside the line?
Just rock and roll that.
You don't have to play a shot outside.
So my questions are these. Is it just English men who seek to sexualise the humiliation cricket heaps upon them? Or does it also exist throughout other cricket playing nations? Is it just cricket, or are other sports also used for this purpose? Obviously, I expect you to answer for all men of every age, class and nationality. And not relevant, but I'm genuinely curious. Why do people write and ask you whether they've played grade cricket? Surely they should know. I was in a performance of Les Mis at Hornsey Town Hall in 2011, but I've never written to Judy Dench asking if this makes me an actor.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you,
that's
Anon.
Up there.
That's really good.
That's up there, Anon.
Just the double-prong nature of the idea of somebody. And, hey, no kink shaming.
We don't do that.
Hey, no kink shaming, all right? If all the pain of grade cricket at least gave you sexual satisfaction, then fucking all power to you, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right? But the idea of that happening and also somebody explaining it with a massive erection, talking to somebody who's playing cards,
yeah,
going along with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Four lagers and a couple of joints.
I don't know if it's an English thing only. Again, you know, my experience with that was at a cricket presentation night in England, and the club president berating the players and the player, you know, spank me daddy. I guess it puts another lens on that.
Yeah.
You know, is it English people only? Like the lazy interpretation is that England were quite humiliated in the 90s. And so what, ergo, they may project that onto their sexual proclivities. So enjoy humiliation. Do you enjoy sex the way you enjoy cricket and vice versa? Is there a parallel there? We were talking about this yesterday, he goes. Like, just watching England just caught in the slipstream of Ravi Ashwin and Virat Kohli, and they were just putting guys at short cover or one in that little box area or whatever.
Yeah.
I thought that's just trying to appear funky, but they've got no idea what's going on. I always thought about those captains who lacked imagination in the field. You know, like the best they could do to stop the flow of runs was to put in a short cover.
Yeah.
I always just thought, you know, just a real meat and three veg kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who enjoyed section the missionary position exclusively.
Yeah, that kind of gear. I don't know if a game, we've spoken about this many times, maybe off air only, but like, is there another sport, game, hobby, pastime that fucks with your brain this much? The anxiety it causes, all of the shame, all of those sorts of things, even involving in this question here. I'm not sure there is. I think that the sheer time that the game goes has to like fuck with your brain that it melts over you in some capacity. Mm. I'm not sure another sport exists, another pastime exists.
But if you can get some sexual fantasy out of it.
Fill your boots.
Then fill your boots, indeed. All right. Last one here. You guys would say?
Yeah.
This is from Clifford Flax. The subject is Steve Bidulph, etc. Dear Pesley Snipes and Woody Higginson, boysies. My 8-year-old, firstborn and only son, is midway through his inaugural season of Master Blasters Junior Cricket. He bowls right-arm beach balls from a standing start and says holding the bat correctly pains his hyper-flexible wrists. He neither hates cricket nor harbours any ambition to be particularly good at it. He plays purely for the joy of being outside with his friends and trying something new. Playing cricket causes him no emotional pain. It's deeply disappointing. The thing is, he's a good-looking rooster thanks to his smoke show of a mother, and he has a decent chance of achieving rig, hair and teeth-based selection to the upper grades in the coming years. On that basis alone, I feel duty-bound to help him hone his craft. It will come as no surprise to you or your listeners that doing so has been profoundly traumatic for us both. If I try to correct his form slash action, or even the most infinitesimally tiny way, in the most infinitesimally tiny way, he recoils from my touch and goes spectral. And who can blame him? It's a true case of the blind leading the blind. I was famous in my junior cricketing days for bowling 25 ball overs and batted around the lower order, hard 11. The greatest contribution I ever made to a cricket team was when I, in accordance with the Machiavellian team Alpha's instructions, went down after being hit on a thigh pad by a ball which didn't really hurt to waste enough time to secure a meaningless draw. Cuck.
Fuck. Cuck. So aggressive. Go down. On the page, yeah.
I once publicly and vociferously tore shreds off my old man for never playing cricket with me after getting out for yet another humiliating duck. Needless to say, but saying it is my version of cutting, I was crying uncontrollably in front of all my friends, Bracken's teammates. The poor guy worked himself half to death for our family and no doubt moved heaven and earth to be able to come to my game only to watch me bring shame upon the family name. As I type the vinegar strokes of this self-flagellatory confession, I feel a strong urge to come completely clean. I have no real interest in helping my son improve his game a lot. I just need him to be good enough to play against, but still be worse than me. With him as my opponent, I can, at least for a short window of time, finally be the intimidating fast bowler and prodigal run scorer my dad could never celebrate. By spending numerous agonising and mutually unenjoyable hours training him in the garage, I mean to show father what it is truly to love a son. My question is this. What would you rather have your son tell his therapist? One, my dad never played cricket with me. Or two, on Sundays my dad would drag me into his garage, which he decked out a la Manus Labuschagne's reimagining of Abu Ghraib, and pelted up taped up golf balls at my young thighs with a sling-powered wanger, leaving me with naught but a broomstick to protect my fragile physical and emotional self. Is there a middle ground? Curtly, Ambrose.
Fucking hell, man. There's a bit going on this.
Oh, I love it.
Dad stuff, I guess.
Can I take on here?
Yeah, please.
I think he's got to do... Look, I want to the question about what he'd rather have his son tell his therapist.
Right.
One is just, my dad never played cricket with me. Two is the Labuschagne Abu Ghraib gear.
Yeah.
One will be cheaper.
Yeah.
Right? That'll be a cheaper experience for your son or whoever's paying for it. Whomever's paying for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd imagine therapists these days would actually have a Google Doc as soon as someone comes in saying like my dad never played cricket with me. Oh yeah, yeah, I know that one. Yep. All right, let's just open that there. Yep. Just tell me that. Yep. Just, you know, like it's probably just an empirically validated flowchart working towards health and well-being. Mm-hmm. You know, they've seen it before. It's a tale as old as time, which we can't play for copyright reasons.
Yeah.
But that'll be in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. All right. A well-trodden path, cheap therapy. Okay, it'll take a few years, but it'll be a pretty well-trodden path, right? Two, the Labuschagne Abu Ghraib problem.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be the subject of conferences around the world for a while.
TED Talks and stuff.
Someone comes in and makes a disclosure, well, not a disclosure in the formal sense, but someone comes in and says, my dad treated me the way Manus Labuschagne used to deck out his garage like Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
That's going to cause a therapist a few problems, as in that's going to take a while to unpack. Yeah. You know, can you imagine going around to like, you know, Parisian psychology conferences where they're discussing the sort of strangest afflictions that people have and some Australian standing up there, like a psychiatrist standing up and go, well, okay, this is the Labuschagne Abu Ghraib issue that a couple of kids are starting to present with.
Yeah. A couple of adults before.
Now, let me first explain the phenomenon of Manus Labuschagne.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he's, when we say Abu
sort of
Ghraib.
Average 35 in Shield cricket, then he's sort of gotten,
He presented his garage as though it was a wonderful fantasy wonderland, you know, for people to play cricket.
Mm.
We actually discovered later it was more of a torture chamber, a site of torture like Abu Ghraib.
Mm.
I just think that would be a funny thing to sit down and piece together. So I'd say if the cheaper, more efficient therapy would be just to not play with him, but the funnier one would be the Abu Ghraib stuff.
Maybe try golf.
Mm.
Golf's a good game. Get lots of guys at hitting the ball. Episode 147 in the can. Thank you very much to Greg Blewett for joining the show.
Blue boy.
Thank you out there to all the boys and girls for tuning in. See you guys on YouTube every single day during the India-England series, of course. Hashtag RCDSC Fridays at patreon.com/GradeCricketer. And we'll be back on this fair show next week.